Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to begin the third part of this historic conference. This is the part where we have the journalists speak about the failure to report. And I have the great honor of introducing a wonderful gentleman who I've met a number of times over the years. Mark Crispin Miller, I can't remember exactly the first time I met him, but I do know that I also introduced Mark at the historic NYC Cannes March for Answers, when we marched through Lower Manhattan, hundreds of us, to show that we are going to continue to demand the answers to our questions. The failure to report part of this event is going to explore the range of different issues concerning the media and their lack of giving us the facts concerning my uncle's murder. So Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He is the author of several books, including Boxed In, The Culture of TV, The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order and Fooled Again, The Real Cause for Electoral Reform. He is also the editor of Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy from 2000 to 2008. His essays and articles have appeared in many journals, magazines, and newspapers throughout the nation and the world, and he has given countless interviews worldwide. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Crispin Miller.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We're going to try to broaden the discussion somewhat. I think it's abundantly clear that the NIST study leaves a lot to be desired, and that there's copious and specific evidence that the official explanation for 9/11 in general, and Building 7 in particular, it strains credulity. But the question is, how come when there's so much evidence that cries out for a new investigation, which after all is what we want, how come when there's so much evidence there seems to be no journalistic response? There's no reporting on this important story. In fact, the more evidence there is, it seems, the less likely any kind of coverage, the more resistant journalists tend to become, and that's not just mainstream journalists, but even on the left as well. There's nothing really particularly unusual about this problem. In other words, the journalistic silence on the vast body of evidence vis-a-vis Building 7, for example, is not unusual. It's something that we've seen repeatedly over the last 50 or 60 years. The reason why you get no journalistic hearing despite all that evidence is that this notion that the official report is faulty is a conspiracy theory, right? And you are all conspiracy theorists, and you've heard a lot of conspiracy theory here. That's the phrase you run into again and again and again and again. So this is the problem that the panel's going to discuss. And I'm going to introduce the other panelists as soon as I make just a couple of very basic points, and they don't require any background in engineering, okay? I think the engineers here will enjoy them, or appreciate them, I should say. First of all, the idea that there might be some kind of an elite conspiracy was once upon a time in this nation's history a given. I mean, if you read widely in the work of the framers, you see that the possibility that their young Republican experiment might be undone by an elite conspiracy was always on their minds. They were preoccupied with this, that the British Empire and its agents and its sympathizers in the United States might do everything they could conspiratorially to destroy this experiment in Republican self-government. This is, you know, just read what they had to say about Aaron Burr, for example. Elite conspiracy was not a crackpot idea, you see, but common sense. So it's important to understand that, that this allergy that we have all developed to anything that smacks of conspiracy theory, where we make the sign of the cross and hold ourselves away, you know, this is fairly recent. And it is particularly germane, I think, to note that it was not commonplace in journalistic discourse until the late 60s. It was not until some authors began to question the findings of the Warren Commission that journalists began to use the phrase conspiracy theory. I should say that the phrase conspiracy theory became current, and it really never stopped being current. We've seen it repeatedly ever since, particularly from 1980 on. And I can suggest that you dig up a declassified CIA memo from April 1st, 1967 that deals with the problem of these authors. This is Mark Lane and Edward J. Epstein had written books questioning the results of the Warren Commission. The CIA said, this is a problem. Our solution is to use our, this is a quote, propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by using the following five arguments. You know, and then there are arguments we keep hearing today, like if there were such a big conspiracy, someone would have talked, something like that. The point is that there it is, it's in black and white, the CIA is suggesting that the media be used to cast aspersions on what were, after all, entirely reasonable questions about the official explanation of the Kennedy assassination. Okay? Well, if you search the phrase conspiracy theory in the archives of the New York Times or Time magazine, it'll take you a few seconds, you see that before the late 60s, the phrase was very, very rarely used. And then after the late 60s, it's used again and again and again and again. I would suggest that if you want to get anywhere with this issue, okay, you cannot keep simply trying to push the evidence on journalists. At the same time, you have to raise a more fundamental question, which is, what do we mean when we say something's a conspiracy theory, right? And why is it self-evident that conspiracies are impossible? Conspiracies against democracy. Why are they any more unlikely now than they were back in 1787, okay? So the fact is, there have been many stories since the 60s that have been treated in exactly this way, stories in which the evidence is overwhelming, which the case has actually been made, you see, and yet somehow that story gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. I don't need to see the evidence. I know it's conspiracy theory because it's unlikely, because it's something I'd rather not believe, or I don't want to get into it, right? So, Our panelists here are eminently qualified to talk about different aspects of this. First, there's Craig Unger, who wrote for Vanity Fair for a long time. He's the author of House of Bush, House of Sod. Yes? There you go. Copies were available, or were, until a few minutes ago. I'm introducing these people very briefly because their own story will be part of their remarks to you tonight. Dick Russell, who journalistic career goes back to the 70s at least. He wrote for the Village Voice. He wrote on the Kennedy assassination. Since then, he helped Bobby Kennedy Jr. write his two indispensable articles on election fraud for Rolling Stone magazine. He is Jesse Ventura's co-author for his books on conspiracy theory. And then And then we're extremely lucky to have with us Leslie Griffith, who was definitely a charter member of the mainstream media. She co-anchored the nation's top-grossing local newscast for 15 years. She is an intrepid investigative reporter, and she has also found that there are limits to how deep you can look into certain stories, or whether you can look into them at all. So because Craig has a pressing engagement, we're going to start with him, and I'm going to ask him to tell us specifically about his experience in trying to investigate the October Surprise in 1980. Oh yeah, let's hear it for the October Surprise, shall we? Right, in the annals of conspiracy, that is a good one. But it is a conspiracy theory, isn't it?
Well, I came to the story in 1991, and it was really a very famous op-ed piece in the New York Times by Gary Sick, who now teaches at Columbia University and runs the Middle East Studies programs there. And Gary, who I've come to know and admire, was on the National Security Council under Jimmy Carter. He had previously been on the National Security Council in Republican administrations. He's sort of the opposite of an ideologue. He's a scholarly. He's really a scholar more than anything. And he had been in the Carter White House in 1979 when Iran seized 52 American hostages. And he was there as Carter tried to negotiate with Iran. He is an Iran specialist and has been for, I think, 40 years or so. And he did not believe the initial charges at all. And it was many years later he began to put them together. It was not until 1991, in other words, 12 years later, that he wrote this article in the New York Times that put forth the theory, for want of a better term, that there'd been secret negotiations between the Reagan-Bush campaign, led by William Casey, who later became head of the CIA, and then had secret meetings and actually delivered arms. These are private citizens. They're not in the U.S. government, to Iran. Then a hostile foreign power making a deal effectively saying, don't return the hostages until after the election. If you return them before, Carter will win. If you return them after, we will arm you for your war with Iran. Iraq. And that, and so this was the what he argued in his op-ed piece, and I began to investigate it, and I did an 8,000-word piece for Esquire magazine, and then the shit hit the fan. And Newsweek actually hired me for a while to lead their investigation, but I was on the story. My friend and colleague Bob Perry was on it and did it for PBS Frontline. He did 2-hour-long documentaries. It's a piece with 10,000 puzzles, and not every question was answered, but many, many, many were, and a picture began to emerge. And what was interesting was the way the story began to be sabotaged. And you would see sources emerge who would go to various reporters, and they would give them exclusive information to a real story, and the story would turn out to be true, and it would make headlines, and the reporter get real excited. And then he'd get another story, and it would be true, and suddenly he was in the national limelight. And then the third story would come, and suddenly it exploded in his face. And this happened to 4 or 5 reporters that I knew of, and you saw it began to be happen, that in other words, sources went out delivering disinformation and thereby discrediting reporters who were investigating, and they saw their career go up in tatters. You also saw certain reporters began attacking those of us who were doing this investigating. There was, I think I was the subject of at least 6 different attacks. Now, I'm not worthy of that many stories. I'm simply not. You don't do 6 stories. One reporter doesn't do 6 stories on me. That's unusual. I know a good story. I'm not that good. and you saw this happen again and again until the story was completely marginalized. There were books on it. There were there was a congressional investigation, and I don't think got to the bottom of it. I began to see that bipartisan commissions doesn't mean they're getting the truth. It means they're agreeing on a political reality often more than actually getting to the bottom of things. I also could see, and I've had happier outcomes in various stories. And for example, when I did House of Bush, House of Saud, which came to me immediate the day of 9/11, I said, "Wait a minute, these are Saudis. The Bushes are very close to the Saudis. What's up with that?" And I started Googling, and within hours, I got to the company called the Carlyle Group, and I saw, I just was Googling Bush, Saudi, and I came to this company, this large private equity firm. I don't think I'd even heard of it, called the Carlyle Group. And they own, it turned out the chief partners in that were the elder George Bush, the younger George Bush, James Baker, several members of what I began to call the House of Bush, a lot of members of the Royal House of Saud, and a family called the Bin Laden family. And I said, gee, that's very interesting. What does that mean? And I went back the next day to the website. Fortunately, I saved some of it to my hard disk, but I went back the next day to their website, and it had been scrubbed. So I... fortunately, there's something on the internet called the Wayback Machine, and you can, it's very hard to scrub your website, even for the Carlyle Group. So I could continue doing research, and House of Bush, House of Saud grew out of that. But when I began shopping the story around, remember, at that time, Bush was the most popular president in the history of the United States. And I went to 6 or 7 publications, all of which rejected the idea out of hand. And finally, Vanity Fair, and to his credit, Graydon Carter is one of the few people who was open to doing stuff that was critical of Bush fairly early on. And that's how the story got launched. But by the time the book came out 2 years later, the tide had turned, and it, you could tell people were hungry for that information.
Okay. I guess it's worth noting that our mutual friend Robert Parry has doggedly stuck with the story of the October surprise and has demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that all the alibis that were used to make the case that Bill Casey couldn't have been meeting with the Iranians, all that evidence is been devastated. And yet still, you ask any person who doesn't think too much about these things, about that story, and it gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. Dick, maybe you could tell us about your work back in the 70s when briefly the window opened and a certain amount of truth was circulating. You know, there were congressional investigations of the CIA. This is in the wake of Watergate. And the left press actually did do a great deal of serious investigative reporting. Maybe you could address this issue for us.
Yeah, they did. The Village Voice in particular, I started writing for in 1975. I was living in New York, and the Voice was very open to covering the Kennedy assassination, the King assassination. There were new investigations going on in the House and the Senate at that time, and I think I did a dozen cover stories or something for the Voice. And the curious thing was that the national media, the bigger media, were totally obfuscating or ignoring what had really happened to Kennedy, even though the House committee was about to come out with a report that said that there was a conspiracy. And that report, by the way, that story, when that report came out, was buried on page 39 of the New York Times alongside the obituary column, I believe, or the classified ads. But now, I wanted to sort of run through a history of what the media did not do, and then a little bit of why back then, and which leads us up to today. I did a piece for The Voice critiquing a CBS News special back in 1975, or 76, I guess. And I noted that the CBS programs that they did then and in 1967 were almost, when they did their first series of specials, were almost identical. And then back in 67, up until the last minute, most of the producers anticipated a script that would raise grave doubts about whether Oswald had acted alone. And then all of a sudden, overnight, something changed. And CBS backed the Warren Commission right down the line. One producer named Bob Richter was so astounded that he resigned. When they did it again in 76, same story. Now, you may have noticed over the years that when a book comes out, like Case Closed by Gerald Posner, or more recently, Vincent Bugliosi's tome, regurgitating the Warren Commission, and basically saying they were right, those books get widely reviewed by the New York Times and others. I don't remember one conspiracy book that's been reviewed by a major newspaper in many, many years. This is despite the fact that way back on November 22nd, 1963, the very first dispatch that came out with the AP reported the shots apparently came from a grassy knoll in the area, which many of you probably realize some of them, or at least one of them, did. Time Life buys the Zapruder film, the famous Zapruder film, right away for $150,000, a huge sum in those days, and then they keep it out of the public domain until the mid-1970s. Nobody can see it. And they're saying that they hold on to all rights. The publisher says it would just be too painful to see this, this film. Well, the publisher of Life magazine at that time was a guy named C.D. Jackson. And in 1977, Carl Bernstein, of Watergate fame, which kind of ignited this investigative reporting possibilities in the 1970s for a while, came out with a piece in Rolling Stone about the CIA and the media. And in that piece, he described how for many years, C.D. Jackson, who was the publisher of Life magazine from 1960 until he died in 64, had been the key guy working on behalf of Time for the CIA. He had been approving their specific arrangements for providing CIA employees with Time Life cover. And this was the guy who held onto the Zapruder film, would not let it be seen. Of course, the media right away is coming out and saying that Oswald was the lone assassin. Life comes out with a report about the Warren Report, and it's illustrating this with the Zapruder film in 1967, again, I think it was. And one of the frames contradicts the Warren Report and contradicts the lone assassin finding. They take that magazine issue back, and they completely redo the plates. I mean, when this was discovered, to their horror, that this was going to show that things were not as they seemed, they redid the magazine completely, took it off the newsstands. They did a big series in 67, and Richard Billings, who was an editor then at the time, he said, it's not Life's function to investigate the Kennedy assassination. Well, it comes out as the years go by. The Bernstein piece in 77, and finally the New York Times even has to do a series on the press and the media and the CIA, that Time Life, CBS News, William Paley, and the New York Times have all signed these agreements with the CIA and providing cover for maybe 400 CIA people all over the world. Now, in those days, of course, the CIA and the, you know, it wasn't considered this evil thing that necessarily and by most people. This was, you know, part of, they all grew up together, they went to the same schools, so it's not terribly surprising. But then you had people like Hal Hendricks, who worked for the Miami News, who gets a Pulitzer Prize for the uncovering, for the, releasing the first stories on the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's also the one who puts out the first stuff about Oswald being this left-wing nut who worked for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. I mean, it's really a pretty endless series of stuff, and I won't go into all of it here. We could maybe get into some of it later, but then you know, as you go through I look back at things like earlier Bill Pepper alluded to the civil trial of Martin Luther King that he was, you know, he initiated not too long ago in the 90s. This, you know, the jury came out and concluded that there had been a conspiracy to kill King by a series of people. Well, what gets the TV coverage? The O.J. Simpson trial. You never heard a thing about this King civil trial. Now, during the Iran-Contra era, as Craig Unger mentioned, I mean, Reagan should have been impeached for his role in trading arms for hostages, but the media would not look at this. And, of course, this was the time corporations began buying up the big media, and then you had this guy Gary Webb, who worked for the San Jose Mercury News and broke this incredible story about the crack epidemic in LA being tied to CIA drug money that was being used to fund the Contras. And Gary Webb was vilified by the big media. Even
first celebrated.
First, very
with
briefly.
With a Pulitzer Prize, with, right? Didn't he win the Pulitzer?
No, he did not. I don't think Gary Webb got the Pulitzer.
Huh.
He won something, and then the big media just went after him. He ended up committing suicide or being killed. Most likely he was killed because otherwise he would have had to shoot himself twice in the head.
Two gunshot wounds to the head.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. And then you get to 2000 and 2004, and a subject Mark knows a great deal about, and we could talk about more as we go on, which is that, you know, the Bush administration steals two elections. The first one, there was a CBS News analysis done. You remember on election night in 2000, it was a guy with Fox News who was a cousin of the Bushes, Fox News breaks it first, and there's a famous thing about this guy getting up on, standing up in the Fox News room that night saying, Jebby, meaning Jeb Bush, Jebby says we got it, Jebby says we got it. So Fox calls it for Florida. What they don't reveal, and nobody talks about until later, of course, is the fact that there was already a fraudulent, you know, a computer glitch that switched votes from Gore to Bush. CBS News later does this internal analysis, and I'll just quote one thing from it, which is that, you know, they talk about how the vote reports were skewed, and had it not been for these errors, the CBS News call for Bush at 2:17 a.m. would not have been made. So that was the first stolen election. They took it with or without the Supreme Court, and then in 2004, I did a couple of pieces, one piece particularly with Bobby Kennedy Jr. on the voting machines, and that was just absolutely blatant. I mean, what they did in Ohio. I mean, they set up a mirror website out in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where you could switch the votes. I mean, incredible story that all the big media should have been all over. And a guy named Mike Connell, who was getting ready to blow the whistle on all this in 2008, was just starting to talk. He'd been involved in setting up all this stuff for the Bush administration in Ohio. Suddenly, his private plane goes down in Akron shortly after the election in 2008. So he's out of the picture and can't tell us anymore what happened. I will quit talking. I could get into the 9/11 stuff. There are so many things that I hope we'll get into as we talk that the media should be looking at about 9/11. You know, not only what we're talking about today, of course, with Building 7 and the other potential demolitions, but many, many things that track all the way back. I'll just say this one more thing. Remember, ever heard of Operation Northwoods? See, most of you are familiar with it, but most of the public is not. The precedent for 9/11 is Operation Northwoods, which was a project of the Joint Chiefs of Staff back in 1962 that was done secretly without Kennedy knowing about it before the missile crisis. And it was revealed for the first time in 2001 in a book by James Bamford called Operation Northwoods. And it was this whole thing. They were going to hijack an airliner. They were going to blame it on the Cubans.
The Joint Chiefs were.
The Joint Chiefs were going to do this, the leading military people in our country. They were going to select passengers and board them under aliases. And eventually, they were going to think about the Pentagon situation, which this is the precedent for that potentially to have happened. They were going to have a drone aircraft. Bamford quotes all this stuff, and they were going to eventually destroy the drone aircraft, and the passengers would be unloaded somewhere else. It was a whole mirror image of what they may have done at the Pentagon on September 11th. So I'll quit talking for the moment, and we'll talk about more of this as we go.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so we've heard from a couple of veteran print journalists. TV is often dismissed as eye candy for the masses, but obviously there's been great investigative stuff on TV. I think one of the reasons why the Republicans consistently try to get rid of PBS is because they don't want Frontline around, because Frontline has done some superb work involving some terrific journalists. So now, Leslie, having thus introduced you, I'd like you to tell the audience about some of your experiences trying to work in an honest way to basically take the First Amendment seriously, tell the people what they need to know, and what kinds of roadblocks you ran up against. I guess it's true, is it not, once your station was purchased by News Corporation?
Okay. Mr. Murdoch.
Mr. Murdoch, go ahead.
And a lot of what Dick just talked about, as I began, thank goodness I was an avid reader because I became a reporter in Moscow during the Cold War. I was sent to Moscow, so I saw the way propaganda worked, which really, really helps. What you see now on television are readers. The two women that took my place, one was Miss Florida, one was Miss Texas. And I don't think they've ever walked outside, except for one time one of them walked outside and I said, you know, you really should take off all those diamonds if you're going into the projects. So this is intentional. We're talking about, and I want Mark to talk about the stolen elections because he is the expert and he has so much humility that he will point to everyone else at this table before himself. But how do you marginalize things? Well, that's one of the ways you do it. You put people in, you know, let's start with, okay, marginalizing people. You get a group of about 9 neocons to buy every single network that used to have boots-on-the-ground reporters, like Dan Rather, that hung out with the Mujahideen and told us how they felt and covered wars and real reporters, and you put them behind a glass table, you put a little grease on their legs, you put a mini skirt on them and some high heels, and it's pretty distracting, but they're sitting in that same chair where that real reporter used to be, so that's confusing. Okay? So that's one way that you marginalize things. You marginalize the news. Another way that you marginalize the television news that, and I talk to my dad about this all the time. Dad, who'd you watch today? Oh, you know, that pretty girl on Fox. You know? So he thinks if they're sitting there, then it must, somebody in power made a decision to put a reporter in that chair. How else do you marginalize things? Michael Jackson dies, you spend 3 weeks outside his house when there is an Iranian revolution going on. And, you know, try being the only person in the room screaming this, plus the fact that you're about to turn 50 and you're booted right out the door. So, you know, there are so many things to talk about. I mean, the stolen elections, the Diebold machines that were confiscated, I can remember sitting there. Are we just going to let this go by? We're just going to show these pictures? As long as you have a picture, nobody has to walk outside. Reporters, the staffs in almost all newsrooms have been cut in half, and I'm sure all of you can speak to this. We know so many great reporters that are they're not reporting anymore. And so this is how you marginalize this. And also, I want you to know, as I listen to some of you beautiful people speak, you reminded me, we were in shock, just like you were on 9/11. And I remember that day, I got a call from Mark Bingham. He was on flight 93. Does anybody know Mark's story? Alice Hoagland's son? Anyway, he's from the Bay Area, and he was on flight 93, which either was hit by a missile, which Dick Cheney says the missiles, he didn't give that order in time for the missiles to hit it, or they fought and the plane went down in a field in Pennsylvania. So we don't know, have the answers to that either. But I was at her house during that day because Mark had called her from the airplane, and I remember running in with that story to say, man, these guys fought back, you know, they fought back, and that was so important to me on that day. And then I remember my last shot on that story was his grandfather. I made the photographer stop and back up and take the shot of the grandfather sitting under the American flag at Mark Bingham's house with all of his family. And I said, is that flag there all the time? Yeah, 24/7 it's there. And he was just sitting there silently. And I asked about him, and he had fought in three different places with Patton. So, these were great patriots. You know, these are people that are still asking questions, just like you're still asking questions. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that a million different things, because that's the way my mind normally works. But this is not the first time, as Mr. Russell explained, as Mr. Unger explained. This is America. This is how we've been fighting. The CIA has been using reporters to spread stories. There's been so much, and the reason that we need good reporters like these three people here is because there's so much propaganda out there, and it can be very subtle, and it's very slow and sort of pulling you into it and believing it. Just like you're afraid to tell your friends about your child. What happened to your child? You can't go with your, you know, out with your the members of your neighborhood anymore. they're the crazy ones. They're the ones that are blind. They're the ones that will not pick up a book. There was a lady in the restroom who said, you know, all of this all depends on Americans being the most stupid people on the planet. So, you know, that's, I know I've told you a million different things. And as I listen today, the reporter in me writes down, oh my gosh, the China steel. Well, I just broke a story not long ago about the Bay Bridge is sitting on compromised concrete, right? That means it's been taken out of construction, beat up. If you've ever seen a pure piece of concrete, it's very strong. My first thought was, oh my God, I got to find out whether our new Bay Bridge got any of that China. That steel from China that came from the World Trade Building number 7. So this is the way reporters' minds work. You know, this could tie into this and this could tie into that, but you don't have those reporters anymore. Who's doing the reporting? Rolling Stone. Why? Because corporate America doesn't have to buy an ad. They don't have to buy, they can do, you know, stories that the mass media can't do because they're so tied into corporate financing of commercials. It's one of the reasons that I walked out the door, because I did a big story on corporate malfeasance. They said there's no way we're going to run it. The commercials, they have $2 million worth of commercials every year. I said, you got to be kidding me. I'm in Rupert Murdoch's world. I can't live here. And that was the end of my television career, and I started writing. So, yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, the best is here. I don't know what I'm doing here, but there they are.
Thank you. I want to make, every time I talk, that happens. Must be
no,
a conspiracy.
It's
yeah. I think it's important to make a distinction, because we've actually brought up two different kinds of two different modes of suppression of the truth. I mean, on the one hand, and I'd like you to address this because I know you're going to have to split. On the one hand, you've got a commercial system that was aggressively deregulated. I'm talking about broadcasting. First by Reagan in 1987, and then by Clinton in 1996. It was a commercial system all along, even though there was a 7-year debate leading up to 1934 when they passed the Communications Act. This is concerned radio. A 7-year debate, a national debate over whether broadcasting in America should be advertising-based or not. Well, the commercial forces won that one. And thenceforth, you know, radio and then TV were advertising-based. However, they were regulated, and they were expected to compensate, stations were expected to compensate the public for profitable use of the public airwaves by doing a lot of public interest programming, see? So the networks and the station owners could make a fortune off this public resource, right, because the airwaves belong to us, but they would have to compensate that public by doing a lot of news, by doing community programming, by doing children's programming, by doing educational programming, by doing religious programming. So the broadcast code in the early days was significant. Plus, there was a strict limit on how many stations one company could own. And there was a fairness doctrine. So that if you presented one side of an issue, somebody had the right to come on and get equal time. Sounds quaint today, right? Well, Reagan got rid of the fairness doctrine and started to raise the number of stations that any one company could own. This process was accelerated by Clinton, right? And the long and short of all this is, you know, that the broadcasters were expected to do less and less public interest programming, and all of that led to the creation of a cartel, which owns our mainstream media. It's like 5 companies. They own significant parts of all the culture industries. This exerts what we call market censorship, okay? That is to say, it has to be lurid, it has to grab as many people as possible right off the bat, and we have to cut our costs. Investigative reporting is expensive, okay? It doesn't, you know, you pay reporters for months just to do research. Well, what is that, a university? No, you need women with, you know, big pneumatic breasts and a lot of, you know, streetwalker hair
to sit there and read stuff and, no, present company accepted. You know, you need to basically dumb down the news as much as possible, right? That all represents a means of censoring the truth. And I don't think the American people are stupid, by the way. I think you can only be as intelligent as your education system and your media allow you to be, okay? Now, that's part one. This suggests that if a story is commercially hot, they will do it. They will run with it. That's what Michael Moore used to think. He told me this. You know, if you can make a money, you can get away with anything you want. Well, that's false. And he learned that was false when Stupid White Men came out right after 9/11. And HarperCollins, his publisher, owned by News Corporation, told him, hey, you got to rewrite this book to give Bush credit for his masterful handling of 9/11. You remember that masterful handling, right? I think it's also called running away. Remember that? Where is he? Where's Bush? They didn't mean that part. They told him, you have to rewrite this book and you have to pay for the printing costs. Okay? Yeah, well, he was he recovered himself and he, you know, actually made a bundle by going public with it, and that just sold more copies. But I can tell you from my own conversation with him right after it happened, he was shaken. Didn't think that could happen, okay? Now, I promise you that the stories we're talking about would interest a lot of people. They would, because they're scandals, right? They're huge scandals. And you don't have to get into all the technical detail, because that stuff doesn't work so well on TV. But somebody like Leslie, you know, could find a way to make it powerful for viewers. That's the complicating factor, is that these sort of interests that we're talking about intervene and let it be known in one way or another that this story is just not cool. Or they don't even have to let it be known. I think more often than the phone call coming from on high is just self-censorship, right? Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, it seems to me there are two kinds of we work in an information economy, and there are at least two aspects that I've noticed. And one is the actual economy of the press and what it means. And we're going through an epic transformation right now with the internet, and newspaper revenues have dropped by 50% in the last 5 years or so. So that whole world is changing, but. Decades ago, people actually used to pay for information, and almost nothing in print or on TV is really paid for by the consumer. If you think, if you buy a magazine, that doesn't cover the cost. I can only think of three magazines, publications, that don't take advertising, and one is Consumer Reports, Mad Magazine, and Cook's Illustrated. Everything else, and I've been the editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine, relies on ads for not more than 90% of its revenues, and that's the vast, vast majority of the press. What you pay for a subscription just doesn't cover it, and even that economy is dying now because of the internet. So to make money in that context is very, very difficult. It's very marginal business to begin with. In addition, as reporters, there's an unseen currency, and that is your sources. They may not pay you money, but they effectively are, and reporters depend on sources, whether you're a good reporter or a lousy reporter. And there was briefly a wonderful website, and it's now defunct, called Media Whores Online, and it took as its premise the idea of essentially being an access whore. That is, reporters will sell their soul for a good source, and they will print, if it brings them a good story, they'll run with it, and they become committed and invested in that narrative. So the most egregious example, I think, in recent years was the New York Times in the lead up to the Iraq War, when Cheney's office leaked to Judith Miller, wow, we've got a great story for you. We're going to give you exclusive information on Iraq's weapons of mass destructions. And that makes her a superstar. And the Times runs with it, runs with it, runs with it for months and months. And I've never seen a reporter come back and say, I'm sorry, but the stuff I've been reporting for the last 5 years was wrong. Reporters don't do that. And so you become invested in that. And there's a real political economy to that in the way reporters make those decisions. And you learn, you get signals what's acceptable and what's not.
Yeah.
Just on a grassroots level, when the wars started, I remember sitting in our editorial room, which was to me just the sacred place, because you know how you fight in an editorial room. Well, if we're going to get that guy, then we got to get this guy. If we're going to say this, then we got to say this. Then we, you know, that's crazy. You're going to go that way? No, let's go this. So you argue and you figure out how can you bring it to the middle? How can you make it balanced? How can you get all sides and show their view? And I remember one of the first things that began to happen was when people started getting laid off, we started getting one feed, which meant I never saw Building 7. I was responsible for telling the Bay Area about Building 7, and I never saw it. Why? There was one feed that our station bought, and Building 7 never came across it. So I'm sitting there, I'm working 24/7, haven't slept in weeks. It's sometimes it's not that person's fault, but this is the way it works. But in the editorial room, I remember thinking, I miss arguing. I miss talking about these things. I miss smart minds that intellectually have conversations with me instead of emotional bullying, which is what began to happen. With fewer and fewer people, the loudest person, the squeaky wheel, got what they wanted, and the intellectuals just sort of wilted, got smaller and smaller and smaller in every newsroom. And I have many, many friends in TV newsrooms all across the country, and they all said the same thing. So that's happening as well. I mean, I want to give them hope, and I'm not giving them any hope.
Well, a couple things come to mind. Just are related to this. For example, with the whole global warming situation, and now less people apparently believe in global warming or climate change today than they did, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, even though the evidence is overwhelming that the weather is changing drastically. But, you know, the media will, in this balanced approach, and also because corporations pay for advertising like big oil and gas and coal companies, you know, they've always got to get the other side of the story. And, you know, so they'll quote this jerk, you know, who's paid by the oil industry to, as an expert from MIT or wherever, to say a certain thing. And you know, it's totally a lie, but they still feel like they've got to give both sides of the story. There is no question, according to every reasonable scientist, that climate change is happening. Everybody in this room knows that.
Yeah. And Fox News puts out a memo to all of their news directors to make sure that they don't do too many climate change stories.
I want to address this. It's a very important point here. The compulsion to be balanced, okay? This is something that has enabled some very powerful interests to, you know, sort of promote themselves and their bottom lines at public expense. It's a particular kind of strategy where you manufacture doubt about something that's beyond question. And of course, the first to do this were the tobacco companies, right? Who managed to persuade the press and others that there were two sides to this issue of the lethality of smoking, right? Of course, you had some doctors, some scientists insisting that there was something wrong with this. On the other hand, you had our the ones we own, these doctors, these scientists, you know, they won't do that. That merchandising of doubt, that selling of doubt, you know, was then picked up by the creationists, right? Now, you know, school boards are encountering these experts who say, no, there's actually two sides to the evolution question. There are actually, there's respectable science behind the claim that the universe is 6,000 years old and that men and dinosaurs walked the earth together, right? So the same thing has happened with global warming. There's supposedly two sides to this. And as Al Gore noted in his documentary, the scientific literature
is basically all saying the same thing, but the popular literature is being balanced, okay? Now, this is the point I want to make for this particular crowd. When it comes to issues like Building 7, when it comes to election fraud, okay, for example, I assure you that they do not take a balanced approach. They will not, first of all, they can't find anybody who will take the other side, right? And usually. And second of all, when confronted with the evidence that we've been talking about, they don't say, oh, that's crap, that's just not true. They'll either laugh it off as conspiracy theory, or they will simply say nothing at all. They will be absolutely silent. This is what's happened with the story of election fraud. Okay, you guys may feel aggrieved because 9/11, you know, gets short shrift, and I share your feelings, okay? But believe me, you have got a thriving grassroots movement pushing for an investigation of this issue, okay? Election fraud is something that nobody talks about. I think I could count on the fingers of like one hand, someone feels this way, the number of people who are involved in this issue full time, even though it is obviously, in its way, the most important issue of all. I want to tell you about a story about this one guy who collected evidence that he was robbed of an election. He helped two other politicians collect evidence that they were robbed, right? This is Clint Curtis. Has anyone heard of this guy?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Clint, is that you? Clint's mom is here. Clint is a computer programmer who was actually asked, he was working for a company called Wang Enterprises in Orlando, Florida, and he was asked by Tom Feeney, a Republican who was then Speaker of the Florida House, if he could develop a computer program that would enable people to manipulate vote counts from outside the system. He was actually asked to do this. And he was assured it was for defensive purposes. The Democrats are going to do this, so we want to know how to do it too. He said, oh, all right, you know. He designed it, and Mrs. Wang, kind of a dragon lady who ran the company, said, no, this isn't for defensive purposes. It's offensive. You got to make sure it works that way. So he washed his hands of it, although he'd already given it over. Well, he decided in 2006, he was so outraged. He had no success making this story known to anyone. He wrote up an affidavit. It went out online. Did anyone pay attention? Have you heard of it? Does the feeling sound familiar to you, right? So he figured, I'm going to run against Tom Feeney. So in 2006, he ran against Tom Feeney, right? And he lost, right? He lost. And two other Democrats, John Russell, well, it doesn't matter. It's in my book. These other two guys also lost. So what he did was he organized door-to-door canvassing for all three of them, very thorough, careful canvassing of their respective districts, and they found that they had actually won, okay? That the margin of their defeat was based on nothing but computer hocus-pocus, or the private owners of these computerized voting systems say so. He collected his evidence. He submitted it to the House Administration Committee, okay, which I believe was chaired by David Bonnier, a Democrat. The committee voted unanimously not to look at the evidence. A unanimous vote. That's not to say they read the evidence and said, nah, this is too shaky. No, they didn't want to know about it. See? So this is something that, affects us all, right?
Well, now that we have a corporate state media, we're asking those who are in it to challenge themselves. They're not going to do that. So we've got to find a new paradigm. And the internet helps, but I've spent 2 weeks in New York trying to talk to as many billionaires as I could about a new idea I have about how to do it with real journalists so that you could produce your own newscast with journalists that could ask the questions that you'd like. But we have to find a new way. Campaign finance reform is hugely important, and what really, like meeting Manny, There are so many young people in this movement, in your movement. I mean, I don't understand why you don't go into politics. You know, change it. Be there. Be the honest politician that says, okay, we're going to look at this no matter what it shows us about ourselves. And, you know, you get to a point where you've told so many lies. It's like in a marriage. If one person is untrue, the other one, you've got to cut the rope at some point. And I feel like after 9/11, we're there. It's, you know, we went through the Kennedy assassination. And I remember Willie McCovey telling me, oh, my God, I thought the world was coming to an end because everybody that liked black people were all of a sudden were getting killed. And then Martin Luther King and then Robert. So the we've been through horrible times before. And the difference now is, you know, it is really time to cut this and say no more. And the only way to do that is campaign finance reform and to get young people. Ted, who's in Berkeley, who I met with last, you know, get out there.
And I think, too, you've got to, there's got to be some historical perspective. And that in other words, that those of us who came of age in the 60s or have looked into the 60s know that, bam, the four great leaders were assassinated not by lone nuts but by a conspiracy, and that's where all this began. And then, you know, on through the years, in the last 30 years since Reagan took over, and it's just been an increasing nightmare. I mean, I'll tell you, even Jesse Ventura, whom I've worked with now in three books, and that's not a story I'll get into at length here, but I met him in a bar in Mexico, and things went from there.
Sounds like a good story.
You know, he was working for MSNBC. After he left the governorship, he decided not to run again, and he was working for MSNBC as a commentator. And he did six shows, and later he told me about this executive who told him that the word came down from on high that they just could not let this guy continue to have such a high profile, because what if he ran as an independent candidate for president? He was extremely popular. And, you know, Jesse tells the truth. I mean, he will get out there. I don't agree with him on everything, but he's a truth teller, and so they bought up his contract for several million dollars and said, you know, you're off the air. So, you know, we've done these books together. We did American Conspiracies, and where we could, you know, he's a great voice, because I'd gathered all his stuff for years, and then he could get out there and, you know, talk on TV in a way that I couldn't do and most people can't do. And so more and more people became aware of things. You know, we have a chapter on 9/11 in that book, and pardon? Yeah, chemtrails we haven't. And he's got a TV show, which you know of. And the new book, I'll give a quick plug, is coming out in about a week, 63 documents the government doesn't want you to read. And it's got a section on 9/11 in it, and he'll be on TV again promoting it. So he's one, to me, he's a truth teller, you know, and he's a good guy. He's an egomaniac, you know, but he's a really good guy, and he will say what he thinks. And we need more people in politics like that. We need more young people certainly standing up and, you know, struggling to get at what's really going on in this country, because we don't live in the same country as when I grew up, and it's become a fascist, you know, a corporatocracy.
Well, yeah.
That's a good question. It's a good question.
She asked if he is worried about his life.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, he worries about his family. He lives in Mexico for 6 months of the year, and you know, he certainly came under a lot of pressure as governor, and there are certainly a lot of people who don't want him to run for higher office, and I don't think he will, although he's open to it. But you know, we don't talk about that too much.
Listen, it's much more efficient to tarnish someone, to neutralize them by casting them as a conspiracy theorist than it is to pop them. You know, when you kill people, that's just a mess. I mean, that raises questions, or should, which is not to say that some people haven't been arguably assassinated, because obviously they have. But when it comes to pesky journalists and so on, or truth tellers, they are tarnished as loonies, right?
Yeah.
And he's one of them, and I'm one of them, and others, you know, many others are cast that way, and that's absolutely, you know, it's important to understand, just bringing the CIA back into this for a moment. You know, I mentioned the memo from 1967. Well, you know, this is a tactic of theirs that they have used for quite a long time. reporters in Iran when they overthrew that country's government in 1953. They overthrew the, you know, Mossadegh and installed the Shah. It was the first democratically elected leader, I think, in the whole region. Some journalists have recalled that the CIA people would ridicule the idea they had anything to do with it. They would make fun of that idea. Similarly, if you go back and you take a look at a newspaper like El Comercio in Chile, which the CIA owned, okay, and which was instrumental in bringing down Allende, it was filled with derisive dismissals of this notion that these nefarious forces were somehow involved in his dilemma. Of course, they were involved. They were heavily involved, you know. They were working very closely through ITT and others with Allende's enemies and so on. So, you know, it's not, as long as you can sort of keep people in that box, right, where they are dismissible, it's certainly
by labeling
not,
them.
You label them,
dehumanizing
right?
them.
I wanted Craig, while he's still here, to talk about, we spoke briefly about a kind of, you know, cybernetic alternatives to the print press and so on. He's working on a new website that I'd like him to talk about.
Right, well, we all grew up in a world where to be in the media, you either had to be with an institution that had access to a printing press or a broadcast studio. And that created an information economy which necessarily was subsidized by billions of dollars in advertising. I think it's $300 billion a year even today. But it also created a class, for better or worse, of so-called professionals like us, of some who had mastered some sort of expertise. Today, if you want to broadcast to 2 billion people, you need a cell phone, really, and video. Or you can tweet to billions of people, literally. So the change in the economy of information is absolutely extraordinary, and essentially it means the information we create is worth virtually zero. And the question is, what is the new model? And what I'm starting with some partners is called Open Topic. It's just gone live in beta, and part of what we're doing is programming Twitter and RSS feeds in an integrated environment so that I've programmed over 1,000 of the best journalists and media outlets that I know of. People will be able to add with a click their Twitter favorite Twitter feeds or Facebook friends. Just as on Facebook you can follow friends, on our site you'll be able to follow your news. And most content aggregators like Huffington Post are designed for the world of search and Google. We're saying that this is the next generation, which is the social media generation of the web, and we're trying to build it out for that. And by the same token, our platform will be sort of open to the public. So if there are, if you want to use it to aggregate your own content and share it with your friends or the general public, you'll be able to do that as well. And we are now, at the risk of being self-promotional, it's opentopic.com.
That's great.
And it's live now in beta. It's in its very primitive stages, but we're evolving day by day.
That's great.
Good for you, Craig. I wondered, may I ask, I know he needs to leave. You need to leave.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, was there any backlash, any pushback with you after you wrote your book about the Saudi family and what happened there?
Well, it was actually, for the most part, a very good success. And with places like CNN, we're very, very helpful. But Newsweek, for example, came after me. And you would feel pushback from certain people. In the end, I welcomed that. And I, for the first time, I felt I really did have access. I think I did over 500 radio and TV interviews, so that I was not complaining. And that sold well. Afterwards, though, I've had both the success and I've had the problems of being marginalized as well. And it's being called a conspiracy nut is what happens.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
Now, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm going to have to leave. I got to get back to New York.
We're going to end it in 15 minutes. Can you stay 15 minutes? Or do you want to run now?
I don't want to put you on the spot or anything.
No. Stay, 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 stay.
I've got it.
All right. Then we can talk. We can talk about him when he's gone. Thanks, Craig.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I guess, you
and
know.
And now there were three.
Now there are three. And nobody had to shoot them. you know, I think we should probably strive. I get the impression from Leslie we want to try to keep this upbeat, you know, because this is actually a hopeful event, you know. It's inspirational, it's hopeful, in that its presumption is that if a certain amount of solid truth gets out one way or another, it will persuade people to act, right? So that's like a good thing. It's a necessary thing. I would expand on Leslie's suggestion a moment ago that we need campaign finance reform. I think what we need is three conjoint reformist drives, radical ones. One is campaign finance reform, obviously, right? Citizens United is a disaster because it allows corporations to give unlimited amounts and thereby own politicians. However, I would suggest that Citizens United also merely provides cover for stolen elections, because if elections are stolen, you know, through both vote suppression and hinky voting systems, it's then very easy to say, well, you know, they spent so much money, they outspent us, so of course we lost, you know? Campaign finance reform and election reform are inseparable. They have to both take place. We have, across the country, voting systems owned and managed by a handful of private companies, right? Private companies with strong Republican agendas, which is to say theocratic agendas. These are Christianist companies. I can't emphasize this strongly enough. ESNS and Diebold Premier, which are the two largest companies, started as one called American Information Systems. That company was started up by two Oklahoma brothers named Bob and Todd Yurasevich, who are foaming at the mouth Christian theocrats. And, you know, there's one brother is at the top of ESNS, and one brother is at the top of Diebold. Now, you know, this is a movement that is based on the assumption that democracy is evil, that majority rule is the devil's tool, that the righteous are in a minority, and that the only way to prevail, therefore, is by fixing elections and buying up the media and destroying the unions, and destroying the public schools, and destroying public broadcasting, et cetera. So this is a radical agenda, at least as far as the owners of the voting systems are concerned, okay? The companies that pulled off the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio, Triad, Smart Tech, and GovTech Solutions, are all Christianist companies, okay? So it's not as if the Islamists are the only ones who are threatening democracy, not in this country. It's a very different kettle of fish, and they're also all over the military. So we need both campaign finance reform and election reform and media reform. We have to have media reform. That is essential, okay? We have to break up these huge monopolies. This oligopolistic structure has to be shattered. You know, there's no reason why a news corporation should own more TV stations than any other company in the country.
With a biased view.
Well, totally with a biased view. But you know, by definition, any single company that has that much power, right, and that much capital has a biased view. And it's not the public view. It's completely anti-democratic, okay? So that's got to stop. Broadcasting has to be re-regulated rigorously. And we need a real public broadcasting system. We don't have one.
Did you know you can call the FCC? I couldn't believe it. 411, hi, can I have the number of the FCC? They give it to me. There's a hotline. Leave a message. What, you know, leave messages. Another thing that's happening that's so good is that you're becoming citizen reporters. Since we've been, a lot of us have been kicked out of the mainstream that have tried to tell all sides of the story and tell the truth, you took up because it involved what? Your grandchildren, your children, and you became involved enough to read everything you could get your hands on. And to me, that's so important. And if I were going to just say one last thing, as I've sat here all day long with you, listening to you, is that somehow, going back to the marriage analogy, Manny, on your desire, all of you, your desire to get out there and get this conspiracy crap off you, just like, when did socialist become a bad word, a person who cares about society? Somehow, you know, we've got to push those away, and the way that you do that is, in my opinion, and these guys are smarter than I am in a lot of ways and have had a lot more experience, but you've got to convince them that now, at this moment in history, truth is more important for our health as a society than these lies. Because, you see, the powers that be, the neocons, keep shoveling dirt on the truth, that pull that steel out of there, get it away, get the stuff out of everybody's sight. But if we, as a group, as Americans that love this country, and when I got back from Moscow, in 86, I kissed the ground because I loved this. I was such a patriot. And to learn what I've learned is a lot like listening to what you've learned, what you've seen. Your eyes are so open. Now, how do you translate that to getting people that think you're a nut? By the way, every one of my friends told me, don't go to that thing. You'll get tied to it, and they won't put you in print. You'll never be able to print anything. And that pissed me off. I thought, damn, I'm going. You know? So if there's a way that the leaders of you can get together and think of a way to convince the powers that be that to tell the truth is the healthiest way to go now, that we are brave enough, strong enough, emotionally secure enough to look at what may have been done to us.
I think a way to do it, too, is maybe there's somebody in this room who's a published writer, or you know someone. But if you know, listening to some of the stories today, I thought, wow, you know, somebody could write a book that could be very effective just doing individual stories of people. You know, a number of you who have gotten involved in this have lost your jobs. You know, marriages have broken up because, you know, you're so dedicated and so passionate about getting the truth of this out. And, you know, do those that's people love that kind of thing. You know, it's a personal story of someone who gave it all up for the sake of, you know, trying to expose what really happened to their family, or, you know, so it's the other thing I think is you've got to somehow, you know, continue to hold how you do it. I mean, hold your politicians accountable. I mean, I'll tell you one quick story. I ran into John Kerry at a fundraiser a couple years ago. And I decided, you know, I've met him once, I've talked to him about ocean issues, I'm just going to go up to him and cut to the chase here. So I went up to him and I said, did you happen to read that piece I did with Bobby Kennedy and Rolling Stone that talked about how with the voting machines they stole the election from you? And he was kind of taken aback, and he said, oh, he says, I don't think so. And then he said, no. He says, yes, I did read that piece. He said, I know I won the election. He said, but by the time, you know, that I could... my lawyers could find a smoking gun, it was too late. Now, I accepted that at the moment. I wrote it down in my notebook, and I think, Mark, you and I talked about it.
He said the same thing to me.
But, you know, then I thought about it later, and I thought, no, wait a minute. Kerry, you know, he's a Massachusetts, used to be liberal, you know, came out of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. If this guy won't say publicly what he knows happened to him, how the hell are we ever going to change it? So, you know, we've got to hold these people accountable, and you who know these things about what happened almost 10 terrible years ago.
You got the engineers, you got the physics of it down. So, you know, I think the country's ready. I do. What's happening in Wisconsin and what's happening in the Midwest, I mean, the people are starting to go, no, uh-uh, it's too much. You've pushed us too far.
Yeah.
And so... it's a good, you know, now is a time, I think, where people can handle what you have to say to them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I had the same experience as Dick with John Kerry. I handed him this book right after it was published in 2005. Met him at a fundraiser. He spends a lot of time at fundraisers. And I said, "You were robbed, Senator." And he said, "I know." Just like that. "I know." And I was staggered by his. I thought it was off the record. And we talked for about 10 minutes. He took the book. He said, "I'm going to read this." He said, "They're in denial." He actually said that to me. Yeah. "They're in denial." He said, "I was just talking the other day to Chris Dodd." And I said, "Chris, these machines, they're dangerous. We got to change them." And you know what he said to me? He said, "We've looked into it. There's nothing to it. They're in denial." Mm-hmm. So I made this heartfelt pitch. And I said, "Look, if you would... if you would simply go public with this, it would make all the difference." He said, I hear what you're saying, and I think that that's true, but there is the sour grapes factor."
Yeah.
I said, "I understand that, but you can actually say," and I started, dictating a speech to him, right? "But, with great regret, you've had to come to the conclusion, blah, 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 it's for the good of the country, et cetera. I was too polite to mention you banked $15 million in the event that this would happen. You're supposed to help with the legal effort." I thought that would be tactless, you see, so I didn't say that. So I'm not making this up, he socked me on the arm, and he gave me a thumbs up. You know what I mean? It made me kind of hot. It was really cool. And then I went on my way. My book tour was starting, and I was on Democracy Now!, right? And I was on with Mark Hertzgard, who was debating with me because he claimed that it wasn't stolen in Ohio because he called somebody there and they told him. So he said, if it's stolen, how come John Kerry doesn't say so? I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I just saw him and he did tell me," right? He got all excited. He said, "Mark Crispin Miller buried the lead here. This is big news." And her producer sent out a press release. "Kerry told me he thinks the race was stolen," right? The internet lit up. People are freaking out. They're either attacking him or they're saying, no, at least he's talking, better late than never. And then in 3 hours, his office released a statement denying that the conversation ever took place. See? My point here is, I don't think you can expect people within that system to come clean. And I'm gonna speak sympathetically about him. This guy did a great thing when he held hearings on Iran-Contra.
In the 80s, yeah.
In the 80s. A great, great, brave thing. And on BCCI, right? The criminal bank, right? That the CIA and others used to launder funds. That took guts, and I think he paid for it. Yeah. I think they scared him to death, right? I think maybe he started getting somebody's little fingers in the mail, things like that, you know what I mean? Who knows what he found in his bed, whose head was lying there when he, despite all his money. So, they're too compromised. It's a system that's based on holding people's secrets, which are often gamey, right? Leslie's point is absolutely right. If enough people rise up, okay, it can't be contained. It can't be stopped. If enough people rise up, and I'm telling you, even though it's disheartening to see, information like you guys have presented, never breaks into the great big public, movie screen of major media. It doesn't even break into leftist media, right? The fact is, as you do your work slowly, gradually, at events like this, talking face to face to individual people, the truth does spread laterally, quietly. This happened with election fraud. It did, despite the blackout. I was completely blacked out on this. So was Bobby Kennedy. Salon referred to him and me as the far left, right? We were the far, we were the Shining Path gorillas. Bobby Kennedy Jr., you know what I mean? With a sombrero and a machete. Can you picture it? Unbelievable. The fact is that if you keep telling the truth and you keep pushing, especially since we have at our disposal this, amazing new technology, the truth can get out there, okay? It is happening in the Midwest as it's happened throughout the Mideast. Do not put your hopes in recall elections, okay? To use the same machines that put those people in power in the first place. I mean, there is considerable evidence that those guys weren't even elected. John Kasich in Ohio, his race, and the attorney general race, only those two outcomes were
way points higher than the exit poll results. Did you know this? That guy wasn't even elected, and he's passed this destructive budget for his billionaire backers, okay? This stuff has to get out. It has to get out. People have to understand what's happening, right? And then when they do, when they all say something, as they must, because he can only suffer so much, things will change. They will.
What about democracy now?
What about it? Hey, listen, don't get me started. Democracy Now!, The Nation magazine, Mother Jones.
Well, we need to cross over. We're all Americans. We talked about this earlier. Am I louder than everybody else or what? Affirmative television, affirmative writing. People want their point of view affirmed. That's what these nine corporations, I like Rachel Maddow. She says things I think I might say. But I'm not going to watch her on a consistent basis. You know why? She's biased. She's not going to teach me anything. I'm going to go watch somebody who's going to have the other point of view, who's going to teach me something. So where do we go for that? That is why that's exactly why I'm saying this. This is your point.
Okay, can I answer you? I mean, I don't know what you mean by why we're looking to the left. I don't look to the left.
You named.
I'm naming magazines that formerly did do real investigative journalism. I don't care what side of the spectrum they're on. They don't do it anymore. I name them. I'm shaming them. I reject them. I have nothing to do with them. I'm not a Democrat. I think Obama's as bad as Bush easily. I do. I didn't vote for him. I'm from Chicago. Listen. Wait. Hang on a minute. No. Excuse. Wait. Yeah. I hear you. Can I respond? You're talking about the Tea Party? The original Tea Party was started by a 9/11 truth guy. Hold on a minute. If you think that this Tea Party is going to help us out, I don't know what you've been smoking, but they are owned by the Koch brothers.
Owned by the Koch brothers. They're
sure. No, I hear you.
And see how much you have in common? How scared are you guys of the government? That's the thing. I feel the same way. I'm always telling my daughter, how can I write a piece that will appeal to both sides? I don't want somebody to go,
she's really believes like I...
Who cares if you believe like your friend believes? You want to help them, if you know something different, make them consider that. I mean, that's what reporters used to do. But some of the things that Mark was talking about is, like if you go to Raw Story, which is a place that I go to in the mornings, I go to reader-supported news only because it's supported by the readers. I mean, somebody that doesn't depend on a Chevron commercial or a DuPont commercial when the DuPont family's been trying to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency forever. And so I feel, you know, that I understand your point, and I make it all the time to ad nauseum with my children. So you're absolutely right. There's this line of demarcation. You're this and I'm this. We label everything now, and it's just got, even my orange is labeled with a number on it. You know, you eat your orange and your apple for lunch, it's labeled. It's enough already. And you, the way you talked today was exactly the way Tea Party people, a lot of them talk, which is, this is crazy. Our government's gone crazy. We can all agree on that. Okay, but it's the specifics that we've got to get people that know how to negotiate. We've got to get people that know that are diplomats. We've got to get honest spirits like this young man that I met last night out there in the front, push them toward the front. Not us old people who have all this baggage to carry.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
You want 5 minutes?
Yes, we gotta go to dinner.
Oh, we got to go to dinner.
Are we done?
Okay, we're finished. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Are these ejection seats?
Wait a minute, I've been here before.
I have to say that watching all those videos of Building 7 blow up has really whet my appetite.
I'm telling you, guys are doing great.
I could eat a horse.
Yeah. And I want to say one more thing before we leave. When you watch that Dan Rather piece, and you look at where Dan Rather is now and where he was then, I want you to remember just the small, tiny example of how the world works that we live in. Dan Rather, we used to be able to actually say as reporters what we saw with our own eyes. The condition of your loved one, you saw that with your own eyes. You knew it. Something was up, all right? Dan Rather looks at that building number 7, and he says, it looks like a demolition. Because at the end of every newscast, there was a fad where they would make us run demolitions because people thought it was cool, or the consultants thought it was cool, or somebody did. So he was saying that we've seen all too often, and that's what he was talking about, that we've had to run the... So he makes that comment. He is the arch nemesis of Papa Bush. They have hated each other since I was a little girl growing up in Texas. He makes that comment, and then he makes a comment about Ashcroft not flying commercial airways, and he asked, why didn't you tell the American people not to fly commercial airliners? So he's pissing everybody off, and then what happens to him next? Classic CIA black op. You know, everything in the memo is true, but the paper couldn't have been, you know, manufactured then. So what do? They threw the whole thing away. Classic CIA black op. Okay, so you've seen a guy who tried to be a reporter like the old-timey reporters we knew. My God, that looks like what you've been begging people to listen to you. He said it right there. And look where he is now. I just saw him 2 weeks ago. He's beautiful. He's still doing great reports, but he's in a tiny little office. He was demoted. And, you know, this is what happens. Another thing I want to say, watching BP, Brian Williams, sweet, kind, funny, you hear him all the time. They pick the most charming people on the planet to be their front people. And I'll be darned if he doesn't say, Rachel Maddow asked him, what do you think of this spill? And he says, the best people in the world, the best engineers in the world are on that BP board. That'll be over with in 2 or 3 days. He's a cheerleader for corporate America, BP. And he said, and he also added, BP has one of the best records that there is, best safety records that there is. And so, you know, this was the beginning of it. So you got to understand what we've got going, because I'm looking at him thinking, you are so cute. Oh, darn. You know?
Yeah.
Because that's what we have, and that's how subtly all of this has happened to us. So no, BP didn't have the best record. They had one of the worst. And no, they didn't stop it. And no, everything wasn't okay. A real reporter would have said, how many people are on that BP board that don't have an interest in making money off of what happens today?
And selling their stock short, a number of them did. And
I've... Consequences.
Right. No consequences.
No consequences for 9/11 either.
Who's
head roll? Okay, closing remarks.
Yeah,
okay, somebody very hungry is asking for closing remarks, and I will make them.
I don't care, but at the end.
I'm going to make some now. Okay. Okay. Can we wrap up? Should I just close? All right. Just talking about, you know, Brian Williams and Dan Rather and all of them. And in fact, the question of getting rid of government and all this. Let's just close on a point about the press in America, the history of the press in America. You know, there's a myth that the free press in the United States is yet another marvelous product of the free market. This is completely false. This is false. It had nothing to do with the glory that was the press in the early American Republic. We had an amazing press here. When de Tocqueville came over from France in 1834, he couldn't believe how many newspapers there were and how great the circulation of newspapers was and how many newspapers people read, no matter how remote their farms might be, okay? We had an amazing, vibrant, free press that represented all points of view, okay? And it was the result of a media policy that was put in place by the framers, and it was based on public funding, okay? The Post Office Act of 1792 had a tremendous amount to do with the availability and the distribution and the affordability of newspapers. There were also printing subsidies provided to newspapers in every state, okay? Some of it was based on political patronage, some of it was not. A great book on this called The Death and Life of American Journalism by Bob McChesney and John Nichols. I strongly recommend it to you. The fact is that the old advertising-based model is dead, it's defunct, okay? The whoremasters who basically paid for the press all these decades are sick of trying to, you know, sick of pouring money into it, basically. They've abandoned it. The press is circling the drain, so we have to start thinking of ways to support a genuinely public press that expresses the will and meets the interests of the people, okay? That's really what this event is about, as well as the unresolved questions and the need for an investigation of Building 7. Okay, thanks very much.